I want to thank the conference organizers for having this this session, which I think is a very extraordinary time in STD treatment and management and previously unforeseen situations. And I want to talk to you about all today about my work on the Sierra Leone Ebola virus persistence study, where I dealt with some of the people behind the pathogens and the risk reduction efforts that we had to undertake along with the testing. So the risk reduction behavioral counseling protocol that we developed was for a variety of fluids. And as Barbara discussed, we had semen was in the pilot phase, and then we added on additional fluids in the main study phase. And so I'll be talking about these fluids together. As I go through this presentation, I will use a few abbreviations, so Ebola virus, EBOV, the Sierra Leone Ebola virus persistence study, VPS, and I'll just say behavioral counseling protocol because the full name is far too long. Was talked about in Barbara's presentation in terms of what we knew before the West Africa Ebola outbreak in terms of persistence. So I won't belabor the point too much, only to say that we went into it knowing that semen was probably going to be the most problematic fluid in terms of persistence and its implications for transmission of the Ebola virus. And so knowing that, we had a lot of upfront work on some of the risk reduction materials for particularly for male Ebola survivors. So a lot of the presentation will talk about their issues in particular. So this is where we started in terms of the recommendations. Early on in the outbreak, WHO had a recommendation for 3 months post-system onset. A lot of times that was heard as 3 months post-discharge. And so survivors would leave Ebola treatment centers knowing that they would need to use condoms or practice abstinence for a few months. A few critical events happened after this first recommendation in terms of the sexual transmission case in Liberia in March of 2015, which Barbara discussed, increasing attention to the role that sexual transmission might be playing in a continued outbreak. And also our publication based on the pilot results of the RT-PCR testing showing persistence in semen for up to 284 days. So the community came together again and we updated our recommendations. It says January 2016, but there were interim recommendations at 6 months and then 12 months accompanied by a testing recommendation as well for the population that was affected. I think we learned a lot of lessons about risk communication as we went through the outbreak and the rapidly changing science and how do you communicate that science to the people that need it and the communities that are affected. So a lot of survivors left the treatment centers knowing the three-month rule because that's what they were told by many of the folks who worked in the centers. But then the six-month rule and the six-month guidance and the 12-month guidance was a little lost in some of the flurry and the new science. So I think risk communication folks learned a lot and contributed a lot to how we went about to communicate these changes. So when we were developing the risk reduction work, this is the reality of Sierra Leone and Liberia, where I also worked in Liberia to do this counseling. Very low condom use in Sierra Leone. These are from the demographic health survey that is done in the region. And high multiple concurrent partnerships, some similarity to some of the STI and HIV work that we do, even domestically, and surprisingly low HIV prevalence. The low HIV prevalence, though a great thing for the countries, also meant that these were not PEPFAR countries. So they didn't have this very robust risk reduction infrastructure to draw from. A lot of what we were doing, while there were some local NGOs and UNAIDS was there and operating, it was a limited infrastructure. So we were starting with a fairly risky, potentially, population and not a lot of prior work to draw from. So there were challenges associated with that. So the protocol that we developed in about May 2015 was to, it had two main objectives, is to provide participants in the virus persistence study their test results using simple explanations, of the RT-PCR testing and virus isolation testing. So emphasis on simple, and we'll get to some of the language we use to kind of try to distill this very complicated paradigm to participants. And also encourage participants to engage in prevention practices until they reach those two consecutive negative tests and were able to graduate from the study. We also built a referral system with the counselors referring participants to available services in the community, which, as I'll discuss, were limited in scope as well. So the protocol itself was adapted from a flexible, theory-driven framework from Project Respect, which some may be familiar with here. They have a very easy-to-use manual, and a lot of the kind of negotiating and some of the concepts that they were drawing from proved to be very useful for us in working in an environment like Sierra Leone and Liberia. So we were working on attitude change, internalized social norms, self-efficacy, beliefs about one's ability to engage in the risk reduction practices, and also, very importantly, relationships with intimate partners. And how that played into their risk reduction efforts. So we had a pre-test delivery results and the post-test counseling. The pre-test counseling happened at the first visit, which I'll show you on a flowchart. Delivery results and post-test counseling happened together in the subsequent visits. So these are kind of the steps that the counselors were taught to engage in when participants came to the study. The first on the left-hand side is pre-test. That's at the first visit, at the baseline visit. They would orient to the study. They would discuss some of the semen testing collection measures and other fluid collection as we added fluids. And also then start to engage in a conversation about sexual health or intimate relationships, the importance of the risk reduction steps. And then the process of negotiating then risk reduction once they established what the intimate partnerships look like and what the particular client or participant was dealing with. We also offered rapid HIV tests at every study visit, as it was we felt that was important information to turn around the participants if we could. And we did a condom demonstrations at every visit, and that proved to be one of the most important parts of the behavioral counseling protocol. And then any referrals. So that was repeated. The subsequent visit, we added the delivery of the previous week's test results before they went to go donate other specimens for testing that came positive that week. It's important to understand, too, many of these survivors who were participants in our study had gone through quite a bit of trauma, and many of them had lost spouses or partners who had gained new partners. So there was very interesting dynamics with relation to sexual risk reduction. So this is just very briefly the timeline of visits, and Barbara went through this in terms of the first visit and repeated coming back and receiving test results. So when we explained the test results of RT-PCR, we said pieces of Ebola were found in the specimen that you provided. And we chose specifically to not say that you had a positive or negative test, because when they were in ETU, that's how they would get their diagnosis of Ebola, is that you were positive or negative. And those words were really laden with a lot of heavy meaning. So we moved away from that, and we were talking in terms of detected, not detected, indeterminate, could not be seen, those kinds of labels. With virus isolation, when we were able to give those results, we discussed that as the virus found in your specimen was alive and possibly infectious. And that was often given months after the RT-PCR testing, which was done in real time. So here is a very convoluted slide on the guidance that we developed for various fluids. This table is a intimate fluids. So what we were calling intimate fluids. So semen, vaginal fluids, urine, rectal fluids, menstrual blood, things that might have a high likelihood of contact during sexual activity. And you can see guidance about abstinence, condom use, also importantly, disposal information of condoms and other products. This is a very low resource environment. We wanted to make sure that our guidance was specific to what they were able to do. So throwing away tissues or using a burn pit or a pit latrine, these were all things that we, in concert with HIV/AIDS and STI operators in the area, were telling us was probably going to work. Then we added some of these, I guess, non-intimate fluids. I never really came up with a great term for that, but things like what to do if sweat is positive or saliva. So it ranged from full abstinence in the case of sweat to abstaining from kissing, oral sex for saliva. So we had to really adapt this guidance for the situations that we would be presented with. Luckily, many of these were not positive, so we didn't actually have to issue the guidance, but we had to prepare it. So these are example of some of the sexual risk reduction messages that we had at our study tent, and this was drawn from material that had been available in Sierra Leone, used for other activities. And we also had the opportunity to create infection prevention control guidance because it was really a contact with the fluid that was wasn't an issue. And so things like after urinating and defecating, how to washing your hands, and some general IPC advice for the household. And these were drawn from some viral meningitis guidelines, and it really hadn't been developed before, so it was a really novel thing for the study. So for this audience, I wanted to just point out some of the main differences between what we have in HIV, and you can also say STIs, and in Ebola. In HIV, sexual fluids are most problematic now, and in Ebola, it was multiple fluids that could potentially carry the risk. It was what we were investigating. Unprotected oral, vaginal, anal, but not manual sex is usually a part of our guidance with HIV and other STIs. But it was really any contact with any positive fluid that was the issue, which is why some of the IPC guidance was necessary. Importantly, HIV would continue to be detected without treatment, but Ebola, we knew it was time delimited. We knew that the guidance was time specific, but we didn't know the time at the time. I wanted to just talk fairly briefly about issues facing female participants, because I have gotten a couple questions about this, and we didn't find a lot of positivity in the fluids that were specific to women, but they did present with unique questions regarding family planning, wanting to have children again, wanting to start that process, and we would encourage them to wait until they got those two consecutive negative tests before engaging in unprotected sexual activity. Breastfeeding was a major topic of concern, and what would happen if we had positive breast milk samples, and how would we go about still maintaining the nutrients to the child, but also protecting the child from Ebola transmission. And so we told them to cease breastfeeding if they got a positive test result, and safely express that breast milk, and were provided infant formula. And also intimate partner violence. That could have been talking to some, we had a focus group with women, and we talked to service providers that worked with women, and we knew that this could be a potential issue, especially if a woman was receiving positive test results, how that information would be received in her household. So we took care to do things around that. I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but really it was only semen that had the prevention advice at pretest, based on the fact that we knew that we'd had evidence for semen persisting. We didn't have that same evidence for some of these other fluids, so we only issued this guidance when we had positive fluids for the other ones. It was really only, so then really only men were getting the prevention advice at pretest, and it was other women. However, we still discussed prevention in terms of HIV, STI risk prevention. We made sure to do a robust risk reduction work with women, but if they had positive tests, then we did quite a bit more. The training required was, intense. We chose people who had HIV, STI backgrounds, or mental health nursing and previous experience, and we had a package of things that we would train them on how to discuss with the participants, which I won't go through every one of them. Importantly, we did, as we started to see men who had multiple positive tests in a row, we wanted to make sure the counselors knew how to work with men and women in that situation who needed some extra support to continue participation. So these are examples of some of the counselor trainings that we did in Sierra Leone and Liberia. We were able to share the counseling with the Men's Health Screening Program in Liberia, which does free semen testing on a programmatic basis, not a research study, so a slightly different environment. But we shared that, and they adapted it, and it's been a very successful program in Liberia, something we're very proud of, and they've reached a lot of survivors. So what kinds of things did we learn through this challenging and incredible endeavor? One of the main things is that the participants in our study, we weren't sure how they were going to receive some of the risk reduction work that we had put together, and especially the condom demonstrations. And it's Sierra Leone and Liberia are not necessarily cultures where these things are discussed very openly. So how would this go? And in fact, they had very high receptivity to the condom demonstrations in particular, and many of the materials we were able to give them. Many of them said this was the first time they'd actually been given a condom demonstration and really benefited from that. So that was gratifying to see that our efforts were appreciated there. I think we all learned the value of transparency and how we tell the people in a community that are affected by evolving science. And I think, individual retention of information, the first recommendation is usually the one that will stick. And so how do you update that in a way that makes clear that we now know more, but we still have more yet to know? And even on an individual basis in the study, delivering virus isolation results or unexpected positive results to somebody who was expecting to be negative or be discharged soon, was important in building the trust between the participants, the study staff, and the larger response. We learned the value of couples counseling as we discovered that even though, and we know this from HIV and STI, but even though the consequences to unprotected sex in a case where there's positive fluids are positive for Ebola could mean transmission of Ebola, there were still individuals who were not using condoms. And, some of them reported that it was their partners who didn't want the condoms to be used because of the connotations and them carrying condoms around. So we really had to address that and develop couples counseling modules. They did that very well in Liberia, and they had, tried to get uptake there. We also realized the importance of trainings for intimate partner violence, but also trying to reach populations where behavior might be criminalized. It is criminalized, MSM behavior is criminalized in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and so doing outreach specifically to MSM and other populations that may be hesitant to present for testing and engage in the response. So we learned I would say we still have a long way to go to kind of reach those populations. In Liberia in particular, we also noted that the participants were telling us that there were participants who had religious objections to semen testing. And so, there tended to be some conservative religious communities. So how do you get to them and have them participate in these programs that are vital for their health? So there's a long way to go to kind of assess the issues in marginalized populations and particularly those who don't want to engage. What we're really proud of with the study, too, is that our efforts with training counselors paid off in terms of the broader response as well. And our counselors that we trained were called upon in these outbreak investigations that occurred, the clusters that Barbara mentioned. They were often asked to help facilitate communication between the surveillance groups or the folks who were doing the investigation and the individual at the heart of the investigation. It could be a fairly fraught environment, and so having a counselor who was trained then in how to have these conversations, how to talk about sexual behavior, and maybe in some cases convince them to donate samples was important for the outbreak and important for us to be able to develop that capacity. We have shared this counseling protocol with several entities that are doing semen testing on a programmatic basis, like as in Liberia, and then also in Sierra Leone, which has packaged semen testing with some other services for survivors, with the National Institutes of Health, and they have a fluid testing study, a very large-scale one happening in Liberia, so we were able to impact and I think hopefully improve the experiences of the individuals undergoing that kind of testing. And also now we have IPC, infection prevention control guidance, where we didn't have it before. Importantly, I wanted to make this point that the underinvestment in mental health and psychosocial support systems, generally the healthcare systems are very weak across Sierra Leone and Liberia, but in particular for this work, the weak systems in those countries really contributed to a limited availability of people who could even do the counseling work. So we were taking from nursing populations, which had varying levels of really training in how to have this kind of dialogue with patients and participants. So there was a lot of training that we did and a lot of, hopefully, capacity building. The other issue is that they often didn't have local supervisors or people who could advise them, on the local context and some of this very novel work that they were doing. So we saw the effects of that, and I think investing in mental health systems globally has a big payoff when things like this occur and when you need folks to be able to communicate to individuals and communities. So I just want to end by saying that that I think that our behavioral counseling protocol and the program that we developed assisted participants in having a place to discuss some very difficult trauma experiences and also just their experiences going through the testing protocol. And it was important in translating these test results to individualized guidance so that they could make and take action in their lives. And we think that these counseling services could be of use to other STIs where persistence could play a role in continued transmission in an outbreak. Thank you.
Hi, I have a question regarding retention, because these countries have limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that you use Project Respect
mm-hmm.
as your model.
Loosely.
Yes.
Loosely.
Okay, so my question is, I would like to understand the logistics because, how were you able to get these people to complete these sessions, knowing that were they actually picked up, or can you tell us a little bit about the logistics of helping these people complete these interventions?
Sure. Actually, retention is something that we're pretty proud of in terms of, I don't know the exact numbers for the later part of the study, but for the pilot, we had almost 95% retention. We didn't have a lot of issues with people dropping out and not returning. We had very good, so we did utilize survivor liaisons back to the community, and they were played a vital role in broadcasting and advertising the study to the community, explaining what it was, and then having follow up with people that were hard to reach or were not coming for whatever reason. So we were able to have a high retention rate. We also, if there were specimen donation problems, we rescheduled. We had counselors discuss issues that the participant may be having. So The logistics actually ended up being a little bit easier in terms of we had a very willing participant community and also a high engagement with the staff, and the staff really took great pride in really respecting and treating the participants very well.
Thank you. Sheena McCormack from London. I'm fascinated by the interaction between the counselor and the participant, because that was really complex information that you were trying to transmit. And I'd be interested in the language you used, and be interested in the dynamic, whether there were male and female counselors. Mm-hmm. You said at the beginning that the health beliefs was part of the history taking. I mean, that's a big area in its own right, but this is really difficult to communicate. If you've been successful in communicating it to your participants, then I would say they will be your best advocates to be mm-hmm. peer counselors further down the line. But you definitely need to check that information has been properly understood.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think when you're doing work like this, iterative evaluation as you're going through is a good idea to check in with the counselors and check in with the participants. So what we did in the beginning was we had what we really started with was the science of transmission as we knew it. And so we did a lot of emphasis in trying to teach that to the counselors in the best and simplest way that we could, and so that they were able to answer the questions of the participants, or at least refer and bring that to our attention, and then we could kind of decide how best was to talk about that. The scripts were translated into Creo, mm-hmm. which is the local language, and then back translated, and so they were using, they were really encouraged to take basically pieces of information and say it in their own language and say it in their own way and however they felt would get through to the particular participant. So there was a lot of emphasis on that. I will say when we did an evaluation of some of our efforts in Liberia, and one of the things that came out of that was that the science of transmission, as much as we tried to make that as simple and distilled as possible, was still really complex, and not many people truly understood what was happening. So, you know, we're always looking for ways to simplify and to have our training modules be accessible for counselors. In terms of the gender of counselors, this is very mm-hmm. interesting. We had in Sierra Leone, we had one male counselor and one female counselor, and they saw participants of both genders. And if you've worked in countries with conservative, you know, cultures, we were worried and we thought that could be an issue, but they were, the counselors were chosen by the military hospital. We didn't have much say there. So, although they were great, they were really great, but we worked a lot with them and how to talk to, especially, you know, women, how to talk to men and men, how to talk to women and how to do these very sensitive interventions. And in our evaluation of the Liberia protocol, which they had almost exclusively female counselors talking exclusively to men, we asked specifically about the gender issue, and nobody really maybe a couple people raised it as any kind of an issue, but repeatedly they said that their interactions with counselors were so positive and they were able to develop these good relationships that they, any kind of fear that they may have had was dispelled by the end. So we were surprised and we were very, you know, we had a lot of gratitude for that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we found age mattered more than
gender. Oh, age, interesting.
Thank you for that presentation, and very sorry to hear that you left the Division of STD Prevention. Too bad for them. I have two questions. One is related to condom use, and if there were any evaluations to know that condom use were effective for Ebola, and the second one about the WHO guidelines. So it seems that, and how the data on duration of shedding actually informed the guidelines, it seems that they determined 3 months of condom use or abstinence, then they expanded it to a year, and then they just said, okay, we give up, and decided to offer a screening to all the men, right? So they didn't keep on expanding the time frame for their recommendations.
Yeah, the guidance development was challenging, I think, for everyone. The intervals of time, really, we were trying to move away from attaching months, a specific number to guidance, because it was changing continuously. And so if you said 3 and then you said 6 and then you said 12, I mean, the community would naturally be very suspicious if you came back and said 18. So what we wanted to really emphasize was that semen testing should be available and that they should be participating in that if they can. And, you know, that would hopefully spur that kind of programmatic development by making that policy requirement. And I forget your first question, but I know it was
condoms
important.
And if it was just assumed that they would protect against Ebola, or
I think we, because of the size of the virus, which I can't remember the numbers, but I know that it was bigger than, it's big.
It's a big virus.
It's a big virus. So we were pretty confident that condoms would be effective.
Unfortunately, we have to move on for time. Hopefully, there'll be some time at the end, but thank you, Nisha.